is submitted. We'll hear argument next in number 86890, Dean Deacons versus William Monahan. You may proceed whenever you're ready, Mr. Etzweiler.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, we're here today asking this Court to overturn a decision which threatens grave interference with state grand jury proceedings. It's our concern that the lower court's opinion will encourage disgruntled subjects of state grand jury investigations to file 1983 suits in the hopes that they can sidetrack the state grand jury process or obtain discovery under liberal civil discovery standards which are not available in the criminal context. I'll briefly summarize the facts. The petitioners in this case are all state law enforcement officers who've been sued in a 1983 action requesting both injunctive relief and money damages. The petitioners executed a search warrant issued by Judge Lennox, an assignment judge in New Jersey who supervises the state grand jury. At the time of the execution of the search warrant, there was a dispute. The plaintiffs claimed that the state was not leaving an adequate inventory to explain what had been taken. And the plaintiffs accordingly telephoned Judge Lennox and obtained from Judge Lennox an order that all of the evidence that was being taken should be sealed in evidence boxes pending judicial resolution of the inventory problem. Also, at the time of the execution, the state issued three state grand jury subpoenas upon the plaintiffs, two of which the plaintiffs complied with, and the third of which, and also a fourth subpoena, which was issued later, the plaintiffs successfully moved to quash, again before Judge Lennox. At a later date, in an attempt to resolve the inventory dispute, the plaintiffs came to the Division of Criminal Justice in Trenton, went through the evidence with a court reporter to take an inventory, and in the process of doing this, came upon evidence which the plaintiffs claimed was being retained illegally by the state in that their Fourth Amendment or attorney-client privileges or work product privileges were being violated. And accordingly, in view of their complaint, the state again resealed this evidence, not the entirety of it, but just three boxes of it, pending judicial resolution of this question, which the state sought by an order to show cause, again before Judge Lennox, compelling the plaintiffs to explain why this resealed evidence should not be unsealed. At that proceeding, the plaintiffs relied upon attorney-client and work product privileges. The plaintiffs filed suit. They did so after the motion to quash and after the first partial unsealing, but before the show cause order. The district court, in viewing these proceedings, concluded that with respect to the equity portion of the lawsuit, that is, with respect to the plaintiff's claim for an injunction for the return of property, that these proceedings showed that the Younger abstention doctrine should apply, and accordingly, the district court dismissed the equity portion. With respect to the damages portion, the court concluded that the pendency of the damages action would substantially impede the state's criminal investigation, and it also dismissed this portion of the suit. The plaintiffs appealed to the United States Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit, The Third Circuit, in reviewing these proceedings, concluded that the district court erred, concluding that these proceedings were not adequate to invoke the Younger abstention doctrine, and remanded the matter to the district court for a hearing on the merits of the plaintiff's request for injunctive relief. With respect to the damages portion, the Third Circuit concluded that even if Younger abstention were applicable, the district court would have no discretion to dismiss and would only be allowed to stay the damages claim pending the Younger abstention proceedings. We submit that the Third Circuit erred.
Mr. Etzler, sometime in your argument, are you going to address your opponent's claim that the case is moot?
I wasn't initially intending to, but I'll be happy to entertain questions on that question.
Well, I don't know that I have any questions. I was just you're going to leave it to your brief, basically.
Well, I have a question, if I may. What is there? What difference will it make whether we just dismiss the case or we, in effect, adopted Judge Adams' position in the Third Circuit?
With respect to the damages claim.
Well, basically what's at issue, what you're arguing about here, is whether the damage claim should be dismissed.
Well, if we're arguing both that the district court has discretion to dismiss the damages claim, and also that the district court was correct with respect to the Younger proceedings on the injunctive claim.
But why do we have to fight about the injunction now? And as I understand it, they no longer seek injunctive relief, and everybody agrees you can fight these issues out in the state court.
They have agreed that they would amend the complaint. They haven't yet done that. Also, one of the points is there is currently allegations of criminal conduct which has resulted in the issuing of state grand jury proceedings, again, with respect to these plaintiffs. I guess what I'm trying to say is that this issue can come up again before them.
But involving the same parties?
Involving the same parties, yes. Let me see.
Some likelihood that's going to happen?
Well, I can't.
You know, it can, but is it any more likely to happen to them than it is to anybody else walking around?
There is an ongoing criminal investigation going on. Subpoenas have been issued. I, of course, am not at liberty to divulge what has happened in the course of the state grand jury proceedings. But
you say they haven't dismissed their complaint yet. Is it clear that they can dismiss their complaint when the proceedings are up here? Is there anything they could have done beyond saying to the appellate court, we no longer have this claim?
What they've said is that if this court will dismiss the claim as moot, if this court will dismiss the petition as moot, we will amend the complaint to delete our request for injunctive damages.
What more could they have done? Can you amend a complaint when the proceeding is on appeal? Can you go into the court of first instance and say, even though this whole proceeding is under the jurisdiction of another court, I want to amend my complaint?
I don't know, Your Honor, there is another factor, and that is that not all of the plaintiffs have been indicted. The issue still remains in live controversy, for example, with respect to Mr. James, who hasn't, as I understand it, agreed to dismiss this claim with prejudice. He could come back later on the same claim. Also, this type of question...
Not a party.
Yes, he is, Your Honor. He's one of the respondents. And he's also a party who has not been indicted. Not all of the plaintiffs have been indicted.
Agreed not to seek an injunction?
I think they've agreed to amend their complaint if this court will dismiss the case.
Both the indicted and the non-indicted.
I don't know if they've agreed to do so dispositively on the merits and not come back into court.
Yeah, but they're all in the same position, all of the respondents.
Well, they're not quite all in the same position in that only some of them have been indicted and some have not.
I know, but vis-à-vis as regards their agreement with respect to the injunction, they're all in the same boat.
They're not quite in the same boat because the plaintiffs who have been indicted will of necessity resolve their Fourth Amendment claims, I presume, in the course of the state criminal litigation. That's not necessarily true with respect to the plaintiffs.
Well, the respondents have also said that it's all right just to stay, that their damage suit be stayed, haven't they?
They have offered that, yes.
Injunction and stay the damages suit until the Fourth Amendment issue is settled in the state courts.
That's the offer which they've made, yes.
And isn't that the relief you seek?
No, we seek a reinsertion of the district court opinion. We don't want the damages
act. The only difference is that you did get a dismissal of the damage claim, but it's not with prejudice.
That's correct.
So that whether you stay it or you just withdraw, close the case and let them file it 2 years from now, what difference does it make?
Well, the pendency of the damages action has a chilling effect.
Does it have any more chilling effect than a letter to you saying as soon as these proceedings are over, I'm going to refile the case?
Psychologically, it does.
That's all that we're asked. Our time is devoted to save the psychological concern.
Well, but these are very important for the states.
I understand, but we generally decide lawsuits. We don't, assuage people's feelings about.
Yes, I know, but this is an important factor under the Younger comedy considerations. Even the pendency of this action is going to, for example, make it hard for our investigators to apply for credit. When they apply for mortgages, their mortgage companies get nervous. It stands as a sword over them. It makes them less enthusiastic about proceeding with the criminal matter. It makes other investigators shy about becoming involved in the criminal prosecution. This is why the...
If it was just dismissed without prejudice, people who really know what they're doing would have the same concern. They would know that if they lose in the state proceeding on the Fourth Amendment claim, the damages action can be reinstituted.
I beg your pardon, Your Honor? If they lose in the...
Can't they file a case again? They can file a case again if they win in the state proceeding. And there's a holding that there was a violation of the Fourth Amendment.
Yes. Of course, it would be preferable if they would take all of these claims into the state system where a single judge could...
Well, they're not required to do that.
Oh, no, I agree.
You're not asserting that. They have every right to file their 1983 damages claim in the federal district court, don't they?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Sure. Now, about if the statute of limitations runs on them because it's dismissed?
It's our
Isn't that a consideration for the district court to make in determining whether to dismiss or not? Isn't that something they should think about?
It very well may be. It's not a consideration which was brought to the attention of the district court in this instance.
So long as the state proceeding goes first, if New Jersey law allows it, you'll get the benefit of res judicata from any favorable findings that the state court makes on the Fourth Amendment.
I think that's probably correct, Your Honor.
And that's true whether the federal damages suit is stayed or dismissed, isn't it?
That's correct. But with respect to the question of the stay or dismiss, another reason we think that the district court should have discretion in these matters is that plaintiffs whose desire is to impede the grand jury investigation are going to have an incentive to attach damages claims to equity actions when they file 1983 lawsuits.
But you're not arguing here, as I understand it, as I understand your response to Justice O'Connor, you're not arguing here that there is no proper damages action here in the event that it is determined either in the state court or somewhere else that there's been a violation of the Fourth Amendment. All you're saying is the damages action perhaps should have been dismissed without prejudice or rather than stayed.
We're arguing that the district court had that discretion, yes.
Let me pursue that just a second. Supposing we were in the district court now, and they came in with a motion to dismiss all their equitable claims. And they say, well, all we're interested in is damages, and we're willing to wait till all the state proceedings are over. Given those facts, would the district judge have discretion to dismiss the damage claim?
We would submit that it would, but of course our case is much easier because we've got the...
And they say the statute of limitations is going to run. Could they dismiss it and just say, I don't want to hear this? I mean, doesn't a federal judge have a duty to, I don't understand your theory. Why would he have discretion to dismiss a valid claim?
He would have...
Say they'd never filed an equitable action, just filed a damage action. Could he just dismiss it because he doesn't want to hear it?
Because if he doesn't do it, they'll be unhappy.
Well, because we don't view the dismissal, again, as a dismissal on the merits. We would submit that he would have the discretion. Of course, the absence...
He would have the discretion, even if there had never been an equitable claim asserted?
We would submit that, but that's not...
He doesn't like cases like this, so he'll dismiss it?
I beg your pardon?
I don't understand your theory. I mean, why... How can a federal judge say, I don't like these 1983 suits, I'll just dismiss it as a matter of discretion?
Well, he can do it under the comity considerations which underlie the Younger abstention doctrine, underlie, for example, this Court's opinion in Fair Assessment versus McNulty on the theory that the pendency, even of the stayed damages action, is going to have a chilling effect upon these investigators as they attempt to pursue the criminal prosecution. And also for policy.
You get pretty timid investigators in New Jersey.
We also have in this case other facets which supported the district court's discretion in this matter, and that's the many questions of state law that were very much intertwined with the federal claims. For example, part of the federal claim here is that they may be resolved. They won't necessarily be resolved with respect to the parties who aren't in the state criminal.
But if they're not, the difference in whether the federal court resolves them first has nothing to do with whether you have a stay or a dismissal. That's a totally irrelevant factor.
That's correct, Your Honor, yes. Going back to the, with respect to the Third Circuit's opinion again, which had covered not only the damages action, but also, of course, the request for injunctive relief, it's our posture that the Third Circuit's opinion will enable subjects of grand jury investigations to chill investigations, to use discovery that they cannot obtain in the course of the criminal investigation, and also will result in dual litigation and meshing both the federal court and the state court in supervising the state grand jury procedures, which are contrary to our system of federalism and the comity principles that lie at the basis of Younger. Perhaps I could talk a bit about the discovery question. Even with respect to the injunctive portion of this suit, the plaintiffs would also have access to discovery, in this instance, at the time of the filing of the suit. With that filing, they served a request for depositions and for the production of documents. Among the documents which they wanted were documents which would divulge what the instructions our investigators had been given before they went to execute the search warrant. It's apparent that type of information could divulge or might divulge to the plaintiffs the theory of the state's case.
Well, presumably you could get a protective order from the federal district court if the district court is going to delay hearing the case in any event.
Yes, Your Honor, but of course the ascertaining whether the protective order is appropriate may very well require the federal judge to look into the grand jury investigation to ascertain what information should be privileged, what information should not be privileged. It might require the federal judge to pull in the prosecutor to ask him what's happening in the course of this criminal investigation. Essentially, it requires the federal judge or may require the federal judge to supervise the grand jury process just like the state judge or as the state judge should be doing. We submit that this is contrary to our notions of federalism.
Again, that would not happen if we were to enter an order vacating the judgment of the Court of Appeals and directing that in accordance with the representation of the opponents, the equitable claims all be dismissed and the damage action be stayed. You'd be protected from this particular risk.
We would be protected, but the rule allowing a permanent stay is not necessarily a good rule for this court to adopt as national policy.
I'm just wondering about disposing of this litigation. That would protect your interests in this litigation, maybe not your views of national policy.
Well, it would not protect our investigators as they go out and apply for mortgages, as they have the
sort of, you're talking about the concerns of discovery and the federal judge butting into the state proceeding. It would protect you from that.
Yes, it would protect us from that, but it would not offer
us the credit rating of the officers involved. I agree with that.
Right. It would not offer us the full protection, which we
think... Nothing but a judgment on the merits will do that.
Or a judgment of dismissal not on the merits.
Well, if the claim isn't destroyed, if it isn't with prejudice, it won't protect them.
But the pending litigation will not be hanging over the subjects of the investigation. Also, if these plaintiffs, it would be preferable if these plaintiffs would pursue all of their claims in the state court system where they have remedies, including 1983 remedies, because in a coordinated system that we can then have a state judge ascertaining, for example, from his review of the grand jury process, whether limited aspects of discovery could go forward, whether limited aspects of the damages action could go forward. It's possible that through limited proceedings, for example, the damages action could be determined to be subject to dismissal under the Harlow versus Fitzgerald standard. That would certainly be preferable to these plaintiffs, other than letting this action hang completely in the federal court pending the Younger abstention proceedings.
Of course, I suspect the only reason in Younger itself we didn't enter a stay instead of a direct dismissal is simply because what was asked for was something we simply would not do. That is, enjoin a state criminal proceeding. It had nothing to do with psychological impact. And had not the request been something we're just not unwilling to do by reason of federal-state comedy, I expect that why shouldn't a stay be the normal remedy rather than dismissal, unless what you're asking for is something that comedy absolutely prevents the federal courts from doing. And damages, comedy, there's no reason why granting damages interferes with the state's proceeding, right?
If the federal court damages suit went forward and concluded before the state proceeding, there would be res judicata there.
There very well may be, yes. There doesn't.
At least there'd have to be a stay. And why do you?
I think, Mr. Justice.
Why do you oppose a stay?
We submit that the matter should be in the discretion of the district court.
Why? Why, as Justice Scalia, why should that be so?
Because essentially for three reasons, the Younger opinion, will be intimidating, the continuation of the damages action will be intimidating investigators. If the stay is not mandatory, these plaintiffs will be continually coming back asking for a lifting of the stay, which will involve the federal judge in looking into the grand jury process. We don't want to encourage plaintiffs who are simply seeking to hinder the process of the grand jury investigation to join a damages action along with their injunctive claim. And we think that this is consistent with the Younger doctrine, somewhat responding to Justice Scalia's question, in that Younger was concerned about federal processes which would enmesh the federal district court in disrupting or having a negative impact upon state matters of importance in state proceedings.
Negative impact would have occurred in Younger no matter when you did it. So long as you enjoin a state criminal proceeding, you're going to have that impact. So we said, get out of here. We're not going to do that. Whereas in this case, it is not the case that giving damages will inevitably impair the state criminal proceeding. It depends entirely on when they're given. So why isn't a stay the only remedy that you should be able to obtain?
Well, a rule which would always mandate that stay would, again, I guess there's two possibilities with a stay. Number one, it's subject to being lifted, or number two, it's not subject to being lifted. Neither of those possibilities is necessarily good. If it's subject to being lifted, of course, upon the plaintiff's contention that the grand jury proceedings are not going expeditiously, then you've got the federal judge intervening. If it's not subject to being lifted, then a preferable rule would be for the states to take the matter over so that it can ascertain whether the damages action can continue without interference upon the grand jury process. May I reserve?
Question. Wasn't the grand jury proceedings terminated before we even granted certiorari?
An indictment was returned. That's correct.
The indictment was returned. And what's the status of the criminal proceeding?
Of the indictment? It's still in pretrial proceedings.
Well, has there been a motion to return the material, and is there some proceeding pending to decide whether there was a violation of the Fourth Amendment?
My understanding is that the plaintiffs have not yet filed such a motion. But I got that from the last time I talked with the attorney who's prosecuting the matter. I presume they still will file such a motion.
Isn't there some limit, time limit, on when they can do that?
There may be, but my understanding, I can't answer that question. There is, of course, a time limit, but often judges extend the time limits, especially in very complex cases such as this. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Utzweiler. Mr. Fitzpatrick, we'll hear now from you. Let me ask you, Mr. Fitzpatrick, your brief on page 21 talks about the mootness issue. And you say at the sentence beginning on the fourth line from the bottom of that page, under these circumstances, plaintiffs have no further interest in pursuing a claim for injunctive relief in the federal courts. If this case is remanded to the district court, plaintiffs will amend their complaint to eliminate any claim for injunctive relief and will further move to stay the damages portion of their Section 1983 action. Now, I take it that is your position.
That is our position, and it's our position for all of our clients, including Mr. James, who's not under indictment.
And you speak for all of your clients?
I speak for all of our clients in this court and below. And we said that, Mr. Chief Justice, because in essence what has occurred here is events have overtaken the need for injunctive relief. There's an indictment. There are motions pending. One motion has already been granted. Our Fourth Amendment claim with respect to lawyer-client privilege has been vindicated in the Superior Court in Bridgeton, New Jersey, by Judge Serrata. Indeed.
That just relates to some of the material.
It relates to some of the materials, and there is a motion pending with respect to our other Fourth Amendment claims as well. We had a forum. At the time there was an indictment, we had a forum for those claims. We raised those claims in the New Jersey forum. Indeed, the court has disposed very early on of the lawyer-client privilege document and returned certain documents to us as a result of our Fourth Amendment claims, and has under consideration today, and has a motion before him today with respect to other of our
Has that motion been argued, Mr. Pistone?
It has not been argued, Your Honor. We have asked for an October 31st date. We're trying to move that along because, for practical reasons, we have clients who have essentially been put out of business by the pendency of the indictment. So we're making effort to move that along. We made the motion, and we believe it'll be heard. If it's not October 31st of this year, it'll be shortly thereafter.
Well, I take it the answer to the mootness argument is that
this case isn't moot because the entire case should have been dismissed by the district judge.
Well, we're prepared to argue that. We're prepared to support the majority of the Third Circuit.
I know there's a good argument that it shouldn't have been dismissed, but there's an argument that it should have been, and that's the issue here. So why is the case moot? Well,
that was the issue when we were seeking injunctive relief. Because it is the injunctive.
The claim is that the entire case should have been dismissed.
Well, I understand that, but it should have been dismissed because of the alleged intrusion on the investigative process by our seeking injunctive relief, not by our seeking damages. And what they argue that since we sought injunctive relief, our claim not only for injunctive relief, but for damages should be dismissed.
And that still is the claim.
And that still is the claim, but we're not making it.
That raises an issue right here in this court.
But we're not seeking. We are no longer seeking.
I know, but you're seeking to stay in court on the damages claim.
Yes, we are.
The other side, it says you shouldn't even be in court on that basis.
Yes, Justice, we are. We are seeking to stay in court, and we are seeking to stay in the federal court on the damage issue, albeit stayed, and we've agreed to the stay.
Yes, you want to stay there, and the other side says, no, you shouldn't even be there.
That's correct.
That.
That's
and
exactly
so we have an issue under Younger.
Well, you have an issue under Younger, but what we say is essentially it's a moot issue because the reason that Younger would be applicable, or the reason it was argued that Younger was applicable to us below, is that we were seeking certain injunctive relief, which we are no longer seeking. See, that didn't happen.
Well, up here, the attorney for the state is telling us that even if the injunctive relief is no longer sought, that somehow Younger principles mandate that the trial court's decision to dismiss the remaining damages action is appropriate.
They have argued that,
yes.
Justice.
So why don't you address yourself to that?
Well, with respect to that, I would say, where is the intrusion? Where is the necessity? Where do the comity principles come into play so as to deprive us of what the Congress has deprive our clients of what the Congress has given them? That is a right to go into the federal court with a 1983 lawsuit. The Congress passed the law and said that essentially under the jurisdiction section that we have the right to original jurisdiction in the federal court. It is defeated. That is the right that was given to us. It is defeated only if, by our bringing that particular action, we are now going to impose ourselves in a way that would violate the federalism principles on the state process, that is, the investigative process, the grand jury process, or some other state process. In this case, it would be investigative and grand jury. What we say is, at that stage, we were seeking certain injunctive relief, which they could argue would impose upon that particular state, those particular state processes. We say that is no longer the case. That happened, unfortunately, about 10 or 15 days after the circuit court decided this case. So that what we argue at this stage with respect to mootness, Justice, is that there is no longer any reason for the federal court to abstain from a case which is validly before it based on comity principles and based on federalism principles.
One of the issues that's before us now.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
You're arguing the merits of an issue that is before us now. Is that the rule under Younger?
Yes, we believe that Younger allows, obviously, and mandates abstention under certain circumstances. And what are those circumstances? There is essentially a three-pronged test.
Is the abstention on the damages claim or on the injunctive claim?
Well, we say that only on the injunctive claim. We say if we brought a damage suit only originally in the federal court, there would be no basis for Younger abstention.
Well, would there be a basis for staying the claim until?
Yes. We think there would be an argument. At that point in time, Chief Justice, we may very well have argued against it. But today we will not argue against it, and I believe our briefs have indicated.
So the live part of this case is the petitioners are saying the district court has discretion to dismiss rather than stay a damages claim in this situation. You say, no, they must only stay it. And does that really make a lot of difference?
Whether they stay it or dismiss it?
Yeah.
Yes, I think it makes a lot of difference because, as has been pointed out here, we have statute of limitations problems in the event it's not. I mean, there's a 2-year statute of limitations. The 2 years is long past.
But the reason that there's no interference is that in this criminal proceeding where you are the state proceeding that's going on is a criminal proceeding in which you are making a motion to return certain evidence, and there's no way in that proceeding to get damages.
That is only partially so, Justice. Because,
well, if there was a ongoing state proceeding that would give you the remedy, that you would be interfering with a state court.
Justice, you see, our case goes far beyond our Fourth Amendment claims.
Yes.
And what we say is we now have a forum for Fourth Amendment claims. Mm-hmm. Where is our forum, Justice? Where is our forum for our claim of deprivation of liberty? Where is our forum for our Fifth Amendment claims? Where is the forum for our claim in our complaint that we were deprived of our property, at least on a temporary basis? Those are all claims that cannot be litigated in the present criminal proceeding in New Jersey.
Now, were any of those claims, other than the Fourth Amendment claim, embraced in your request for an injunction against the state proceedings?
No, they were not. No, they were not. No, they were not. Just the Fourth Amendment claim, Your Honor, was embraced in the injunctive request, is my recollection. So that the injunctive request really only went to part of our case. And what we argue to this court is that we are entitled to a federal forum on damages, because that's all that's left in this case. Had the situation been as it is today, we would have never moved for injunctive relief.
May I ask you?
Because it wasn't necessary.
On the, you say about the injunction, you're not fighting for it. Would it be your position that it would be appropriate for this court to vacate the judgment of the Third Circuit insofar as it contemplated further proceedings for equitable relief? Do you have any?
Your Honor, we believe that would dispose of the.
I know it would dispose. Do you have any interest in a litigant in not seeing that happen?
As a litigant, no. As a lawyer, obviously I do. But our litigants do not have an interest in that because they do not.
Your litigants really have no interest in defending that portion of the Court of Appeals judgment.
That's correct.
The only thing you want to do is be able to maintain your damage act.
That's correct. Indeed, the dissent at the Court of Appeals was a dissent only with respect to.
You would be happy with Judge Adams' position.
We'll take either of the opinions at the Third Circuit. At this stage, we argued at the Third Circuit.
But you really don't care. Your litigants really don't care.
The litigants do not care. It is of no moment to any litigant in this case that injunctive relief would be available. They're not looking for it and don't want it.
The correctness of the district court's action, whether it should dismiss or should have dismissed or should have stayed, depends on what the factual situation was at that time. At the time that it took that action, and at that action, the injunction matter was alive.
Well,
can we reverse the district court on the basis of a new state of facts? It seems to me that its action was either right at the time or wrong at the time.
Well, that's correct.
And if there should have been a dismissal then, because there was an injunction pending, why shouldn't we say that?
You should say that if that's what the judgment of this court is based on those facts. I haven't gotten to argue that, but I would argue to this court that the district court was there. But if you can say that, and if this court were to say precisely what Your Honor has just said and leave our damage case in place, it would be of no moment to our litigants. Now, I think it's important, again, taking up the different stages, and I had intended to argue that because, frankly, it is our position before this court that at no stage was younger abstention appropriate, even as events came about. The one thing that we would point out to the court is that we did not seek to enjoin the prosecution. We, as they did in Younger, we did not seek to declare unconstitutional the statute on which the investigation, such as it was going forward. We did not attack the investigation. That was not the focus of the attack in this case. The attack in this case was an attack on the conduct of individual state officers in performing that investigation. We didn't say the state shouldn't be able to indict these people because there's something wrong with the statute, it's unconstitutional, or it's in bad faith. We don't allege that the investigation in this case was in bad faith.
The Fourth Amendment, among other things.
We allege that the investigation as carried out by the individual defendant petitioners in this case was conduct which violated the constitutional rights of the respondents. Mm-hmm. We allege that. And in doing so, we did not ask to enjoin the prosecution. And today, we do not ask to enjoin even those acts. We ask that the court, that the case go forward with respect to damages. Now,
you've got, in this criminal proceeding, you've got the rest of your Fourth Amendment claim pending.
Yes, we do, Your Honor. No, we do not. We have another part of our Fourth Amendment claim pending. If Your Honor, please, let me explain that.
Part of it is over.
Part's decided, part's before the court, and part...
Now, you don't want to go forward on the damages claim on that part in the federal court.
See, we don't have...
If you did and had it decided, it would foreclose the state court.
You see, Your Honor, we don't have a Fourth Amendment claim for damages per se. What we've alleged in our complaint is that there are a host of constitutional violations which were caused by an improper effort by the state to coerce several of the clients to give testimony against other individuals in Cape May County. Our Fourth Amendment claim is really threefold. One, it had to do with return of documents that were subject to lawyer-client privilege. It had to do with the return of documents that were outside the scope of the warrant. And it had to do with the officers going the way they conducted the search, the way they went out into the yard of this particular area and looked at the serial numbers, for instance, on all of the construction equipment was there, had nothing whatever to do with what the warrant was issued for. It was simply an effort to find out really
what were your clients indicted for?
They were indicted for a conspiracy to a bribery case, essentially, conspiracy and bribery. Had nothing to do at all with the equipment. The effort was to see if they could pick up a serial number off a piece of equipment that was stolen or some problem with it, so that they could then come in and use that to browbeat them to give testimony against other people who they wished to indict. That was the effort. We have no forum for that, even today, because it doesn't challenge the warrant. The warrant didn't say that they could go out into the yard and look at the equipment in the yard. The magistrate, the judge who issued the warrant, he didn't say they could do that. They took that upon themselves. The magistrate or the judge in this case who issued the warrant did not say, listen, fellas, go in there with a blank subpoena, and if you see something that you want, we'll have an attorney sign the subpoena in blank, and if you see something that isn't under the warrant, but you want to pick it up later, fill out this grand jury subpoena and hand it to them, which is what we allege in our complaint occurred. They stacked up all these documents that weren't, had nothing to do with the warrant, sat down with their blank subpoena, and issued a blank subpoena. We can't challenge the warrant on that basis, because the judge didn't authorize that type of conduct.
You can challenge you can raise all of these Fourth Amendment questions in state court now, the same way that you could sue for damages on them in the federal court, can't you?
We can raise them only insofar as they affect documents that are presently in the possession of the state or those that would be offered, say, in evidence. those that are evidence against us.
Or any verbal testimony by officers gained contrary to the warrant.
Correct, Your Honor. Yes, yes, Justice.
Well,
could
I ask, make sure?
But there won't be. You see,
weren't there more than, how many defendants have been indicted? Three?
Two defendants, and one company. One company, one partnership, and one individual.
How many of the plaintiffs have not been indicted?
Three.
Three. And
three,
the two
one individual, one partnership, and one company.
And one company. Now, those are unindicted plaintiffs.
Yes. Yes. Now, if at different times in the progeny of Younger, the court has looked at what facts should we look at in determining whether or not Younger should apply. For instance, in Middlesex County, the belated effort by the New Jersey Supreme Court to provide that petitioner a remedy for his constitutional claims was considered, even though that didn't occur until after the Third Circuit's decision. In the Hicks case, there was an indictment that was considered. What we argue to this court is we're prepared to analyze this case at any stage and argue to the court that there was never an ongoing state proceeding which was an adequate forum for all of the relevant issues which we raised in the district court. And that's because there was never a forum even today that would allow us to raise those constitutional claims except for some of the constitutional claims under the Fourth Amendment.
Is it not true that the claims that are not could not be decided in a state forum are all damages claims?
No. There are other claims which – there are other claims – I'm sorry, I missed part of your question. Are you saying to me that
you say can only be decided in the federal court, such as though they're trying to put pressure on your people to testify. There's no state forum for that, but you're not seeking – you never sought an injunction against that, did you?
No, we
did not.
You were
just on the damages.
We did not. And there is a state forum. In all honesty, I must say that we could file the exact pleading in the state court, but the Congress allows us to file it in the federal court. We chose to do it. So there is a forum. The question,
but
as I understand –
But it's that to the extent that you are describing claims that you think – you have no state remedy other than a 1983 claim, are basically damage claims.
Yes. Yes. Correct.
You're willing
on all of them, even the one aspect of the Fourth Amendment that we can't raise is a damage claim. It's not an injunctive claim. We have no injunctive claims any longer. The injunctive claims were mooted by what occurred.
Mr. Fitzpatrick, you could have brought your 1983 claims for damages in the state court, if you're
Yes, we could have. We could
have the option of federal or state court.
Yes, Justice, we had an option. We believe the Congress gave us that option, and we selected the federal court. We believe that in applying Younger, this court ought to respect, and we argue to you, you should respect our choice of forum, unless what we're doing is so offensive to the principles of comity.
Let's just assume that the only claim that you had in the federal court for which you ask an injunction and damages was simply that there was a certain of the evidence was seized in violation of the Fourth Amendment, and you wanted an injunction, and then there was an indictment, you could raise every claim you had except damages could be raised in the criminal proceeding. Would you say that this federal proceeding could go forward just on damages?
I would argue yes, and I also know I'd be in a lot of trouble in this court in arguing yes, but I would argue to you yes. But the fact is that's not our case.
Well, I know, but you keep saying you could go forward on your damages claim, if the federal case was decided before the state case, you would be foreclosing the state court from deciding your Fourth Amendment claim.
Justice, I don't believe that in the real world that there's any chance that that could happen, well, especially given the calendars of what they are in New Jersey today. We would never get a decision.
Just say that you would never go forward on your damages claim in my example in the federal court.
I'm sorry, you lost me.
Well,
I think the state
criminal proceeding is just as much, almost as much interfered with by holding in the federal court that evidence has been seized in violation of the Fourth Amendment.
Yes, Your Honor, and I could understand it makes it a much
closer... And it takes as long to get to the criminal proceeding as this, as it may be that the federal court could get your damages case decided before anything significant happens in the state court.
Most doubtful that that could happen. But let me get back to the earlier point, Justice, which you made. If that were the only case, that is, our Fourth Amendment claims that we now have pending in New Jersey, that would make this case a closer case. That would make it a much closer case respecting whether there ought to be younger abstention. Because obviously, the state provided us a forum. They did it in a way that we didn't appreciate. That was through an indictment, but we have a forum to test it, except for damages. But that's not this case. This case goes far beyond anything which we are now or can litigate in the state court. It goes to violations of 1983 violations far beyond those aspects of the Fourth Amendment. And that's why we most respectfully argue to this court, you must look at our entire case. Look at and find out whether or not there was an ongoing state proceeding at any stage which could have allowed us to litigate those claims, the claims of deprivation of liberty, the claims of deprivation of property, having nothing whatever to do with the matters under which our indictment or under which our clients are indicted. Indeed, I say to you, whether or not our clients are convicted is irrelevant to that lawsuit, because either the state officers on October 5th, 1984, when they went there, they either violated the constitutional rights of our clients or not. And even if they were guilty of something, they were entitled not to have their rights violated, and we allege they were violated in more ways than merely the seizing of the documents, which are now being challenged pursuant to our Fourth Amendment motions in the state court. Now,
may I ask you one question about state procedure? In this case, I don't remember his name. There's one state court judge that seems to have been supervising the grand jury, issued the...
Lennox.
He operated in about three different areas of the law. Is that typical, or is that just kind of a coincidence?
That is most unusual. If we were to file a state case, it would be in Cape May County, and Judge Lennox is in Trenton. It happens because Judge Lennox is the assignment judge in Trenton. The state grand jury sits in Trenton, and Judge Lennox has been assigned to supervise the procedure of the state grand jury.
He doesn't automatically do that as assignment judge.
No, but he also had a second role. It happened that he was the issuing magistrate for the warrant as well. But the state could have gone to any judge. Indeed, municipal magistrates are available and others. In this case, they chose because they regularly take their business to that court. It just happens it's across the street.
And
so that's why they go there.
He's the one who was ruling on things like whether some documents were seized that were not described in the warrant and so forth. Is that because he was in charge of the grand jury, because he was the assignment judge, or because he issued the warrant?
It's because, frankly, I arrived on the scene on October 5th and got Judge Lennox on the phone, and I was the lawyer who complained that we weren't getting a receipt for these documents. So when Judge Lennox heard that, he said, seal them all, and he put them under seal. The federal case, you have to understand the chronology.
He did that because he was the issuing...
Because he was the issuing magistrate or the issuing judge. But the chronology is important, Justice. This case was started before the state filed an ex parte order to show cause. There was no proceeding pending. There was no state proceeding that pending when this complaint was filed. So if this court were to look at where we were on December 27, 1984, when this complaint was filed, there were no state proceedings pending. The state proceeding came, and I wrote it down, but it's sometime in February or March of 1985, by virtue of an order to show cause that the state brought. They brought it and then, of course, let that order to show cause sit there. We argue to you, reason tells us that they did that so that they could have created a proceeding that they could go to the federal court and say, oh, look, there's a proceeding in New Jersey on some of these same matters, so you ought to throw these plaintiffs out of the federal district court. Because they, despite the urging of Judge Lennox, for over a year, they did absolutely nothing with the order to show cause. Nothing occurred. It just sat there. And then when something happened, we wrote to Judge Lennox, and Judge Lennox said, this case is deemed withdrawn because of this hiatus and this inaction. So that while they were bound and determined to get this order to show cause, certainly the state showed not so great diligence in following up on their order to show cause, although they obviously pointed to it at every stage in the federal proceeding. Finally, Justices, let me say that the Potomac case, the Potomac Electric Company case, it juxtaposed to our case, I think amply demonstrates what the true differences are here. In that case, the plaintiff sought to have declared unconstitutional the underlying statutes with which they were threatened an indictment. And they sought to have essentially affect the investigation by having the statute it was based on declared unconstitutional. Not so here. In our case, we did not do that. And that's the difference. Because if you consider a grand jury to be an ongoing state proceeding, we would argue to the court that it's not an ongoing state judicial proceeding, and that there is no certainty that Potomac Electric would have ever gotten to argue its case. Indeed, since there was no indictment, what we argue indeed came true in Potomac Electric. They never got to be able to argue the constitutionality of the underlying statute because there was no indictment. But in our case, that is not what occurred. We are not challenging that. We're not challenging any statute, and therefore we are in a different position. We are in a position where there is absolutely no adequate forum in the state court by virtue of an ongoing proceeding, even if there's an indictment.
After you've gone over all of this, do you agree that if we say injunction is out, damages are in, you're satisfied?
I'm satisfied, I'll go home.
Well, what is all this argument about?
It's over as far as I'm concerned, Justice Wetzel. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fitzpatrick. Mr. Etzweiler, you have 4 minutes remaining.
Thank you. With respect to the mootness question, and it's particularly with respect to the mootness of the question whether state grand jury proceedings are judicial proceedings for the purposes of the Younger Abstention Doctrine, this is certainly a case which is capable of repetition but evasive of review. This Court has before it two cases, the Pepco versus Sachs case out of the Fourth Circuit. It has this case out of the Third Circuit holding directly conflicting theories. In the Pepco case, the grand jury chose not to return an indictment. In this case, the grand jury chose to return an indictment. It's very likely that every time this issue arises in the Third Circuit, by the time it gets to this Court, even in a very complex case as this nature, in which the grand jury proceedings were extensive, one status to the other is going to arise. Therefore, it would be evasive of review. It's certainly capable of repetition in this case because there are grand jury proceedings outstanding with respect to these plaintiffs, because these plaintiffs may again have a search warrant or other proceedings in the course of those grand jury proceedings, because these plaintiffs have agreed to abandon their injunctive claims with respect to this indictment, but they haven't agreed to abandon these claims with respect to any future criminal proceedings which may ensue and which are currently under investigation. Also, what we are reviewing here is the propriety of the district court opinion in which a dismissal was entered. That dismissal was premised in part upon the facts as existed at the time it entered its judgment, and it was premised in part upon its conclusion that Younger applied by virtue of the ongoing grand jury proceedings. To review that judgment and to review whether that dismissal was proper requires an adjudication of the first question which we've raised, that is whether the grand jury proceedings are state proceedings for the purposes of the Younger Abstention Doctrine. That's with respect to mootness. With respect to when these state proceedings were started, and with respect to part of what my opponent here was saying in his argument, we submit that the proceedings, the state proceedings, were started, first of all, with Mr. Fitzpatrick's telephone call with Judge Lennox seeking the sealing order. It may have been started earlier with the judge's issuing of a search warrant. In our last brief out in this matter, we made some comparison. A search warrant is very much like an ex parte writ of attachment. State officials go to a judge. They submit an affidavit. They get an order, which is called a search warrant. It allows them to go and take property and to retain that property until such time as the plaintiffs come into court in New Jersey under a Rule 357 motion explaining why the state should not retain that property. That's very much like an ex parte writ of attachment, which this court, I think, in Traynor versus Hernandez found sufficient for state ongoing proceedings. So we dispute that the proceedings in this case started at the late date, which my opponent says. We submit that they started much earlier. Third, with respect to the question whether these plaintiffs are seeking to enjoin the grand jury, I want to point out, first of all, the Perez versus Ledesma case, which the Third Circuit had no problem with this question. They agreed taking documents away from a grand jury investigation, which would substantially interfere with these proceedings. And they partially relied upon case law from this case. I think if you look at Perez versus Ledesma, you will find that was one of the companion cases to Younger, that in this case, this court held that the district court's adjudication that Texas officials had to return property was a substantial interference. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Atzuela. The case is submitted.
The Honorable Court is now adjourned until Monday next at 10 o'clock.